Welcome back. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're along tonight, and hope you're having a good holiday season. If you've been to the website at Rentz.com and looked under Featured Stories, you'll see right up near the top the name of Eustace Mullins. Mr. Mullins, without a question of a doubt, is, in my humble view, the one man that you can turn to and hear the most accurate representation of how the Western world, in fact the world, is being run, how it is being administered to by the controllers, who the controllers are, and what the game is. And it is a deadly game indeed. Eustace Mullins is up there in Featured Stories. You'll see at the top the first of two pieces under his name is a video. I want all of you to watch the video. It's about, it's close to 2 hours. Watch it in two pieces if you need to. I would urge you to watch it a second time in maybe 3-4 weeks and allow this material to begin to sink in. I've had an awful lot of brilliant people on the program. I have met no one in my life who understands the world better than Eustace Mullins, and he has a remarkable story to tell. You can see it on Rentz.com via the video, and better yet, if you can get any of his books, they are truly classics. And he's standing by right now on the East Coast to spend an hour with us. Welcome back to the program, Eustace. Thank you.
Oh, yes, I'm glad to have the opportunity to clarify a mystery. The mystery is that for many years, no one has been able to come up with a cause for World War I in 1914.
Exactly.
And in fact, the cause was quite obvious to everyone at that time, but no historian has ever bothered to explain to the people of the world what was going on in 1914.
Well, they give very superficial explanations, but they don't get to the meat of the issue.
Well, the explanations are propaganda explanations, because the explanations are, one, German imperial desires,
mm-hmm.
and number two, the fact that there was an economic rivalry between Germany and England at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as simple as that, but that's the whole story.
So it's basically a question of money again. German ingenuity.
Always money, all the way.
And always. German ingenuity rivaling the Rothschilds in England, and the Rothschilds not liking that, of course. It's a very simple but very profound difference between the two, and it literally caused World War I. Now, that being said, Eustace Mullins, who financed World War One? I know the answer to this, but I'm just laying it out there.
Well, the answer is that we did.
Okay.
And that by passing the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, as a central bank, and the principal job of a central bank is war finance. And so the Rothschilds have been patiently waiting since 1885
mm-hmm.
to have a world war.
Mm-hmm.
And they could not do it until they mobilized the credit of the American people.
Ah,
and that was done in 1913 when Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act, and we promptly loaned England $400 million cash from the Federal Reserve.
1913. When he signed the Federal Reserve Act, Eustace, he basically signed away the United States of America to Zionist international banking interests.
Yes, he signed away the role of the American people in history, because the American people returned to a colonial existence of the Rothschild family, as they had been a ward of the British colonials
mm-hmm.
prior to the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm, the crown, yeah.
Exactly the same situation.
So,
and we have fulfilled that colonial position ever since, very loyally.
Loyally? We've been so dumbed down now, that's almost genetic with this culture of ours. It's sad.
Well, you know, Woodrow Wilson almost gave the whole story away when he announced that all wars are economic in origin, which is perfectly true. The World War One was an economic rivalry between Germany and Great Britain,
mm-hmm.
in which the Germans were winning.
Mm-hmm.
And so Great Britain had to do something to shut them down. and World War One was the answer. Germany lost that war, and they lost temporarily their economic position, but due to their superior production, they bounced right back and started passing Britain again. So we had to have a second World War in 1941.
The recovery of Germany from the outrage of the League of Nations was one of the modern miracles of our times, clearly.
Oh, it certainly was. And Woodrow Wilson, I have characterized him as the greatest mass murderer of the 20th century, because he not only set in motion World War One, which killed about 500 million people, but he set in motion World War Two through his protege, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And Roosevelt led us through World War II as a disciple of Woodrow Wilson.
When you say 500 million people died as a result of World War One, you're talking about a worldwide ramification.
Oh, I'm not talking about struggles of armies. I'm talking about the worldwide situation in which whole populations suffered famine, and widespread disease, and I'm talking about total numbers here.
Right, right.
Now, the historians go by the numbers of actual soldiers who were killed on either side.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Now,
those figures are very suspect anyway.
The other question about World War One that most people don't understand is, how was it that the United States was ordered into the war by the Rothschilds?
Oh, yes, but the American people had nothing to say about it. And, you know, the World War One and World War Two were actually civil wars because the structure of the American people at that time, in 1914, was 62% German ethnic in origin.
See, 52?
62.
Gee.
And that was also true in World War II. And a good friend of mine happened to be George Sylvester Viereck, who represented Germany in the United States in both World Wars. And he was sent to prison for that. And
we had in the late 30s in the United States, I guess it was called the German Bund, which was an American association of those of German heritage, which was huge. The mass of America wanted nothing to do with European wars, especially wars against Germany. They had relatives and roots there that went back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Now, let me go back a little bit to the Treaty of Versailles after World War One. It was hardly a treaty, but the reparations and the onus placed on a defeated Germany were so huge, and the invasion of Germany by the Bolsheviks, the Zionist Bolsheviks from the East, was intolerable to the German people, who had, again, centuries of pride of achievement in the arts and the sciences and literature and music and all of that. So the Treaty of Versailles really, was it not, Eustace, a blueprint for World War II?
Oh, yes. The Versailles Peace Conference in Paris in 1919 laid out World War II in detail. And Bernard Baruch was the chief organizer of the reparations against Germany, which could not be paid. And so they laid World War II into place at Versailles and came about quite naturally.
When you think about it, ladies and gentlemen, and I hope you do a little more reading on this, it's all in Eustace Mullen's books, the reparations that were laid on Germany were absolutely impossible.
Oh, yes. No one believes that they could be paid.
No, and that guaranteed what would happen in Germany. Now, it took a special kind of set of circumstances in Germany and a special leader in Germany. Who was behind the rise of Adolf Hitler in Germany?
Well, the rise of Adolf Hitler was not due to any German support. The German people had no interest in Nazism or support for it. Hitler was financed totally by the two biggest German bankers in Germany, who were Max Warburg and Max Oppenheim. And after World War II, the two banking houses in Germany that were restored to preeminence were Max Warburg Company and Max Oppenheimer Company.
Both Zionist Jewish bankers.
Oh, yes, they were part of the World Organization.
Okay, now
they're not Germans at all.
That's very important. This is hard for people to understand. This has nothing to do with being anti-Jewish or anything of the sort. This is talking about Zionism, and if they were Zionist Catholics, it would be the same thing. So these particular banks, we're going to take a break and come right back with Eustace, financed the growth and development of the National Socialists and Adolf Hitler. And we'll come right back in just a couple minutes with Eustace Mullins. And again, I would urge you to go and look at that video in the featured stories section. Study it and go and look at it again in a month and let the clarity of this incredible presentation really make its full presentation to you. And then you decide. But hear him out and listen very carefully. Be right back in just a couple minutes. Talking with Eustace Mullins, whose grasp of history is nothing less than astonishing. What happened in the European theater was the financing of the National Socialists, headed by Adolf Hitler, who was not a German but an Austrian, and it hit a chord with the German people, who had been so humiliated, so humbled, so disgraced, discredited, and subjugated after World War I, that they just rose to it like a moth to a flame, reasserting all the magnificent abilities that they had. And this was a very predictable thing. But as you heard Mr. Mullins say a few minutes ago, right after World War II, the two giant Zionist Jewish banks were immediately reconstituted. So, again, outside interference clear all the way. Even Winston Churchill in his autobiography said that the war in Europe was not a war against National Socialism at all. It didn't matter if Adolf Hitler was the head of the party or the Pope of Rome. It was a war to destroy Germany and the German people once and for all. And it was a war of genocide. Wasn't it, Eustace?
Oh, and the general, our most famous general, General Patton, when he became an occupier of Germany after World War II, he was amazed to find out that the German people were not National Socialists at all. And never had been.
Only it is said that less than 5% of the German military were even members of the party. They didn't care.
A very small percentage.
Yeah. Now, how was it that Hitler, being financed by these outside interests who were actually within Germany, but they were certainly connected directly to the Rothschild banking interests and cartel, how was Hitler financed, and how was it that, I guess they knew this, that the German people rose up almost as one to reclaim their heritage and destiny with such incredible vigor in the 1930s?
Well, there's a nature of their people to respond like that. And it was an amazing thing. It was the miracle of Europe. And but you say Germany was very cruelly used by the victorious Allies. There was a Britain instituted a blockade of Germany in which an entire generation of Germans were almost starved to death. In fact, the 1920 and subsequent generations of Germans were stunted in growth, only about half their usual size, and they were very severely physically handicapped by this.
Throughout the 20s, after the end of World War I, Germany suffered hideously.
Oh, yes, and the occupation of the Ruhr Valley by French and Negro troops caused a birth of a large number of mulatto German children, mm-hmm. which became quite a problem for the whole country.
So they brought them up from Africa?
Yes.
I didn't know that aspect.
Oh, they were pure Senegalese. They were Senegal tribes, and mm-hmm. they were pure African.
Mm-hmm.
And the children that were born from those unions were complete mulattoes people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, with respect to during the war, opposition to the National Socialist Party, only one newspaper was allowed to be printed in Germany during the war in terms of an opposition publication. That was the Zionist newspaper, which shouldn't come to anyone's great surprise if you study history. What about that Zionist link during the war in Germany?
Well, there was a very prominent Zionist link with National Socialism all during the war. For instance, Adolf Eichmann was actually Hitler's personal representative in the Middle East, into what became Israel later on.
Mm-hmm.
He was the personal representative of the Zionists and Germany both during the 1930s.
Right, I've read about that.
And that's why he was executed, supposedly, because he had all the details of the National Socialist collaboration with Zionism in the Middle East all during the 1930s.
Now, as we know, Germany was bombed by the Americans and the British, literally from 1942 on. If we study history, we also know that German air raids against England were only started after Berlin was bombed and other cities in Germany were bombed. It was provoked, and
right,
that's what happened.
It was a retaliatory bombing.
Right. What about Rudolf Hess's mission to England to meet with the those who wanted peace?
Well, there was a very sympathetic group in England, which was very sympathetic to National Socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you see, there was very strong family ties between many German families and many British families. So that carried a lot of weight in England anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So this all came about quite naturally. And because of that support in England, Hess believed that he could go over and negotiate to these people and bring a conclusion to the war.
Hitler did not want to invade England at all.
No.
The people don't understand that. In terms of the opposition to World War II, the communists, the Bolsheviks, who financed them, Eustace Mullins?
Well, they were mostly financed by the Dulles family. You know, the Dulles, the founder of the CIA.
The Dulles brothers.
Yeah. Well, see, the Dulles brothers spent World War II in Switzerland. And they were financing opposition movements throughout the World War II in Germany itself.
Okay, stand by. We have to take another break. We'll come right back and continue our conversation. A quick overview of World War One and World War II as financed by international banking cartels in just a minute. During the war, the Dulles brothers, John Foster and Allen, were in Switzerland handling the money game. The Soviets were being financed by whom, Eustace?
Oh, the Soviets are being financed by the Washington government.
Yeah.
Over $100 billion went from the American people to Russia during World War II.
That's at minimum, and they called it land.
That is the minimum, $100 billion.
They called it land lease, but as we know, there was no lease about it at all. It's like
there was no land lease. It never existed.
No, it's just like loaning money.
The Federal Reserve was printing the money.
Yeah.
And no payment was ever expected from it.
Well, it's just like the money we've loaned to the Zionist state of Israel since its inception is supposedly.
Yeah. It's now $9 billion a year.
Yeah. Well,
there's
no
counting and no payment for that.
No, not a penny will ever come back. So Joseph Stalin is getting money from the United States. He has unlimited manpower and begins a campaign of throwing human waves. And we're talking about millions of men into the face of German armor. And then Americans don't understand that 90% of World War II took place in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. It was a war on the Eastern Front. It was truly World War II. The amount of money that went to the Soviets, the Bolsheviks, was enormous. And it is also an interesting aspect that the Harriman, well, one of the Harrimans, Averill, I guess, the Harriman brothers, went to Russia. Tell us about that during the war.
Well, he supposedly went to Russia, sent by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1942. And the reason he went to Russia was that Stalin had suffered a complete physical breakdown because Hitler had overrun most of Russia at that time. And he was not capable of ruling the country at all.
Hmm.
So they said he sent Averill Harriman over to rule in his stead.
Really? Nobody knows this.
He stayed there from 42 to 44 as the complete dictator of Russia, replacing Stalin. And then Stalin slowly recovered and was able to participate in the Tehran conference with Roosevelt and Stalin.
Mm-hmm. At Yalta, the other, I guess they met twice, the big conferences. Roosevelt, of course, gave away and consigned millions to their death. He gave away Eastern Europe to the Bolsheviks.
Oh yes,
which was another outrage. Tell us more about that and the dealings and how Europe was carved up.
Well, these were the so-called captive nations. And those captive nations had large ethnic populations in the United States, particularly in Chicago and Cleveland, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And, Milwaukee, Wisconsin was a German city. And that was one of the main ones. That's where Joe McCarthy came from, Wisconsin.
Hmm.
But these were indigent German population in the United States. They were mostly farmers. They were very hard workers. And they were very good citizens. And, of course, they had nothing to do with the selling out of Europe to Stalin himself. But
the big issue is the money made by the international banking cartel
astronomical sums.
And they're still making it today.
Oh, yes, they certainly are.
Now, going back to Germany and Hitler's vision of Europe, had Hitler won the war, to the best of your ability, what would Europe have taken on in terms of a configuration?
Well, it would have taken on the further development of Sweden and Norway and Denmark, because he had already occupied those countries,
mm-hmm.
and he would have had governors installed there who would carry on his work. So the picture of Europe would be entirely different. You wouldn't have Eastern Europe given to Stalin, and Scandinavian Europe would be a much bigger and stronger population.
There was a magazine published in English, and I've got some copies of it, called Signal, in Germany.
Oh, I've seen that many times.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in 1944, there were articles in the magazine predicting quite clearly what the Zionist plans for Europe, Western Europe, were. And they laid out a map back then which basically reflects what we have today, the European Union and the subjugation of country after country and culture after culture. They knew.
Oh, yeah, they had very complete plans for Europe, and they were very, very well laid out. Now, one part of what I was going to talk about, the concealing of the origins of World War One. At the end of World War One, 800 American officers were discharged in Europe at the request to look for work in Europe. And the reason they were discharged, the Rothschilds arranged for their early discharge because they had work for them to do. And they hired these 800 American officers to cover Europe and completely cover up the role of the Rothschilds in starting World War One. That's why there was never a reason given for the start of World War One in Europe. That was done by the setting up of a special Rothschild organization called the Hoover Institution of War, Peace, and Revolution, which is now headquarters at Stanford University in California. And a lot of public leaders have come out of the Hoover Institution. For instance, George Bush's present Secretary of State, she was provost at Stanford University.
That's right.
And that's why she was chosen to become Secretary of State, because she had this Hoover and Rothschild background. And no one could understand why she was chosen for that job. But of course, I knew what her background was. And I have written a complete history of the Hoover Institution in my book, The World Order.
Amazing.
Details are completed. And the Hoover Institution went to every capital in Europe and bought or stole or destroyed all documents implicating the Rothschilds and the start of World War One.
Fascinating.
And that's why no historian has been able, since 1919, to come up with a reason for World War One, because the Rothschilds destroyed all that. They spent many millions of dollars in this campaign.
Huh.
And they
Stand by right there, Eustace, if you would. Hold on, we have to take a break. That's a fascinating footnote in history, which explains a lot. Be right back. So the origins of World War One have been expunged from the records of history.
Well, they took the records of every capital in Europe and absolutely grabbed them and bought them or stole them or anything they had to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the Rothschilds, because there was no history of World War One, the Rothschilds were in the clear, and they were never exposed for the fact that they set up the whole deal.
And World War II, basically.
World War II was simply, as Ezra Pound broadcast from Italy in 1940 and 1941, it was simply Chapter 2 of World War One.
Ezra was on radio from Italy in 1940-41.
And he was indicted by Alger Hiss for treason because he broadcast. He was giving aid and comfort to a wartime enemy.
Uh-huh.
Well, in fact, he gave no aid and comfort to Italy whatsoever, and he was never tried on those charges because there was absolutely no evidence. His broadcasts from Radio Rome were directed to the United States, urging the American people not to be suckered into World War II as they had been in World War One. In fact, he said exactly the same thing which Charles Lindbergh was saying in the American First Party here in the United States.
I ran one of Lindbergh's speeches not too long ago on my website, a really remarkable speech, 1940, I believe it was.
Well, he was a highly intelligent man, and his father, Congressman Lindbergh, had led the opposition to the Federal Reserve System in Congress in 1912.
Some people will ask if you tell them that World War II was both sides of it were financed by the, basically the same same money treasure chest. If Hitler and Germany had been victorious in defeating the Bolsheviks and had won World War II, how would the Rothschilds have benefited?
They would have been in very deep trouble because Hitler did seize the property of the Rothschilds in Austria.
Hitler kind of got out of control, didn't he, after being set up? Isn't that part of it?
Well, he did get under. He got out of control because in 1939, Hitler was the absolute mastery of the entire continent of Europe. He had extinguished all opposition, and the Rothschilds were no longer running the whole show. So that's why World War II had to be fought. To free the Rothschild.
To take Germany down once again and free the Rothschild.
And it was just a repeat performance. The whole thing was remarkably easy to set up. And, you know, after World War II, there was a great outcry in Europe to try the war criminals, the people that set this war up.
Oh, there
and
was.
And, of course, they chose Adolf Hitler as the only war criminal of the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Max Warburg and Max Oppenheimer set up the whole deal.
Now you, it's all amazing. You have a view that is very unique about why, with the German cities being bombed for literally 4 years, day and night, not military targets, civilian targets, why so few Jews died in those immolations, such as Dresden and Schweinfurt and all the rest of them.
Well, it was no accident. Because Hitler knew he was losing the war, and he knew that after he lost the war, he was going to be tried and probably executed. And so he got all of the Jews out of the German cities, which are going to be bombed into oblivion by the B-17s, and he put them in rural camps in all over rural Germany. But what happened was that after the invasion of France, the Americans assumed complete control of the air in Germany, and their planes shot down every truck, car, and train which moved in the continent of Germany. So they could not supply any food to the concentration camps where the Jews were. So the American Air Force is totally responsible for the so-called Holocaust of the Jews because they starved to death because they couldn't get any food to them.
The interesting thing is that Germany itself, of course, was starving. I've talked to and interviewed on the program people who were very young and went through the war. The population was starving. And as you say, the American fighter pilots were shooting everything that moved, from cows to trucks to trains. And yet
I knew this because I had a fraternity brother who was a fighter pilot, and they told me of this total command that the fighter pilots had over Germany in the last days of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And you could not get one loaf of bread to any concentration camp where the Jews were.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Jews simply starved. That's why you had those pictures of the emaciated Jews in the concentration camps.
And many others as well.
And many others, yes.
Other
prisoners died just equally. They weren't just Jews.
Yeah,
and probably Anne Frank might have died of the same thing. I don't know.
It's an issue of starvation countrywide, of disease. I had one fellow on the program here who, like many in those horrible camps, came down with disease as well, and was in a hospital ward and told on this program how, and these were all Germans who were very, very sick, and they wheeled in, the nurses wheeled in a large gas tank, a steel gas tank, into the middle of the hospital ward and just turned the valve on and flooded the ward to try to kill all the lice. And the guy asked, I think he was 14 at the time, he asked what this was, and they said it was Zyklon B.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So they were using that to try to disinfect the hospitals as well, because the disease that was afflicting those in the camps, those horrible camps, was afflicting Germans all over the place as well. It was simply a question of starvation, immune systems being destroyed. Now, this is not to sanction for 1 minute the stealing of people's homes, property, and putting anyone in camps.
No,
that's inhuman. That's not acceptable. But Hitler apparently had an idea that had he been able to hold his country together long enough and had peace negotiations been actually instituted, say, in 1944 late, that he would have used the Jews as bargaining chips? Is that part of it?
He was expecting to save his own life and the top Nazis. By using these Jews who had been preserved all during the war, mm-hmm. they wouldn't have been killed at all. And that was his strategy, and it was a very good strategy, but he didn't count on the Allied control of the air, which made it impossible to get any food to the camps.
Or many of the cities of Germany as well. This whole thing was incredible.
The camps. Camps, of course, as you know, were in rural areas where they didn't have the best roads in the world.
And none of them were ever targeted, by the way, for bombing raids, of course.
Oh,
none
never.
Of them,
in
never
fact,
touched.
That still comes up, the fact that the strategic bombing survey could have brought an end to this whole situation by the bombing the prisoner of war camps.
Or certainly
but they never dropped one bomb.
No, nothing. It was, well, they were labor camps, and they were producing money, and those, of course, were, in many cases, monies that went to the financiers of the war, and they didn't want their paychecks and their largesse interfered with.
Well, the atomic bombing of Japan came about for the same reason, because the American Air Force and the American Navy had sunk all of the ships that were bringing provisions and even ammunition into Japan. And so the idea that Japan was going to kill a million American soldiers who invaded Japan was absolute nonsense. They had nothing left to fight with.
Wow.
And Truman boasted for years that he saved a million American lives by dropping an atomic bomb. And he didn't save one American life. And because the Americans occupied Japan, and not one American was touched during the occupation. They could walk home drunk from bars back to their barracks, and not one soldier was ever even struck, much less molested in any way.
So to recap World War II, financed by the Oppenheim Bank and the Warburg Bank, in Germany, with money, of course, from Wall Street to back it up.
And they would have been tried as war criminals because of the tremendous outcry from the Jews themselves. They knew that this was an inside job, and they knew the names of these people.
Right.
But
right.
No inquiry commission ever brought up the subject in any way.
So World Zionism sacrificed the Jewish people to the horrors
of
the camps.
Well, that's been their custom through history.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an accepted technique because it pays off in the long run. See, they got the State of Israel by putting up with this situation in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, if you read the letter of and the writings of Rabbi Michael Dov Wiesmandl, who tried to... Eichmann's people gave him an offer. Give me $3 million and we'll give you all the Jews of Europe. They can go to Spain and they'll give them money as they cross the border.
Which were worked up.
But the Zionists...
They haven't given any consideration.
No, the Zionists said no.
They said, well, of course, they had their own agenda.
That's right. Eustace, thank you very much for being here. Mention a couple of your books that are still available online very quickly.
Yes, The World Order has the only history of the Hoover Institution. It's the only place it's ever been written, and it illuminates the whole situation.
All right. Thank you, Eustace. I appreciate you staying up late back there.
I was glad to give you this information.
Great. We'll talk to you.
This cover-up that the Rothschilds made on World War One actually is responsible for all my work, because Ezra Pound became so intrigued by this mystery of what happened in World War One that he started 30 years of research.
Well, amazing.
And that research was turned over to me and became the basis of my work.
Okay. We'll talk to you again, Eustace. Thank you very much. Okay. And we're going to pause, and we'll be right back.